So yes, my work is on the degradation of a quantum directional reference frame, and it's with Jean-Christian Bourdeau. You may remember a talk that was quite similar last year by JC. I actually talked on a related subject to do with quantum computing with a lack of classical reference. JC did a talk that was kind of, I guess, a forerunner to this work. He made an interesting observation and did some cool calculations. And then I got involved in his project. So I'm going to give you a little quick reminder in case last year you were as inebriated as I was during that talk. So I'm also going to answer the questions of why you should care about reference frames generally. Some of you may already know, but for those of you who don't, it's actually quite interesting. What is the problem we're studying? How do we study it? And what kind of interesting results can we get from doing that? Okay, so the only slide I have to say in my slightly drunken state that I remember from JC's talk last year was this one. Scared the life out of me. This is the man that you take your questions to about this conference. So thanks again to the organizers, by the way. So reference frames. What is a reference frame? When you're doing some sort of calculation, it's nice to have kind of a zero on your axes where you can define everything in relation to you. So as I say in my first point, they can be internal or external to the system you're trying to describe. So maybe in a suitably classical example, I'm bouncing a ball against a wall. I can say that the wall is external to my system, right? In which case, the wall does not recoil from the ball, bouncing off of it, and I just measure where the ball is relative to the wall. However, in that situation, it appears the angular momentum of the ball is not conserved because the direction changes, right? But in reality, the wall receives a slight recoil. It's attached to the whole Earth. This is negligible, but it is happening, right? So to treat it with the recoil would be to make it internal, okay? So if you're going to do that with a quantum system, if you're going to make your reference frame internal to a quantum system, you're going to have to give it quantum degrees of freedom and associated quantum operators that may not commute. If you treat it as external, then it's just something that's kind of in our minds, it's abstract, and we're just invoking it to think of how we're going to measure things. In quantum mechanics, that will define a basis for you. You'll see in a minute. Okay, so just an example of what I'm talking about here and where people were stressed about this. People were particularly stressed about this in the 60s because they were concerned that maybe they couldn't make superpositions over certain variables like charge. Turns out this is not a problem at all, as you can see from kind of various superconducting qubits. But so everyone, I think, is, well, the physicists anyway, are familiar with the Stern-Gerlach experiment. Initially, it was done with a bunch of silver atoms in an oven. You heat them up to kind of a thermal equilibrium. They come through some slits that are in just one focused beam. Maybe that's the x-axis. They go through a inhomogeneous magnetic field, okay, and that defines for us a z-axis. Then they impinge upon a screen. So this is they're being measured when they go through the field. So what happens is you, at that moment, project into the up or down state, shall we say, relative to the z-axis. Okay, the spin half particles, I should mention, silver atoms. Now, let's take this apparatus we just had and put it in interstellar space. We're going to take our whole lab and we're just going to float it out there. Now we're going to conserve the total angular momentum of our lab along the x-axis. This seems a perfectly reasonable thing to do. If you're a physicist, you believe it has to happen. Okay, so we're gonna make an operator for our total angular momentum out of the angular momentum of our lab and the angular momentum of our small particle, which is with the small jx is. But this doesn't commute with the measurement we're trying to do. So it would kind of suggest we can't actually measure whether the spin is up or down while conserving the x value of total angular momentum. So it looks a bit spooky, and that's just due to the fact that the small jx and the small jz don't commute, if you know the angular momentum commutation relations. But the measurement we are actually performing is to compare the total angular momentum of the lab with that of the small spin. Right? That's the only thing we can ever talk about. So what we're actually measuring is a complete j squared measurement, okay, where this is the total, just measuring the total angular momentum, okay, regardless of direction. And so then we're just comparing the two angular momenta. This does commute, and we can perform this measurement. Usually we just ignore the small detail and we say, oh, well, it's close enough, right? And in most cases it is, but this is strictly what we're actually doing. Okay, so what is the problem? This problem was introduced by Bartlett, Rudolph, Speckens, and Turner in a paper last year. What they have is a large spin J system, which they're going to use as the reference to decide whether a small spin is pointed up or down. Okay, so we have maybe some classical reference frame, Z, okay, and we use that to initialize in some way. We can imagine some transformation. For our sake, let's just say it's a direct one, so this becomes this is pointed in the same direction as Z, and it's J, so M equals J. Okay, so it's fully aligned along the Z-axis, and it's in a well-defined state. And then we're just going to find out whether these are predicted up or down. Okay, well, how do we do that? It's just by analogy to what I just talked about. We're going to project into the J minus a half and J plus a half total angular momentum spaces. Okay, this is the only thing we can measure in this case, because we're ignoring the classical reference frame. We're not using it for any interactions. Okay, just using the quantum one. So this is the best we can do, is just compare. Are the two spins pointing in the same direction? Yes or no? Okay. So we can define a fidelity function to say what is the likelihood that we get the correct result. This is possibly a slightly unusual way of defining fidelity, but that seems to be the way people are doing it in the literature, which means the fidelity doesn't start from one. The first time you use a finite-sized spin system for a quantum reference frame, it can get the wrong answer. Okay. So what it can do is it can take a spin that's pointed down, couple it in, it goes to the J minus a half space. When you decouple it, it goes into the plus state, and you just lose a unit of angular momentum from the big spin. So it goes to J minus 1. So the M value is now J minus 1. It's just lost a unit of angular momentum along the Z-axis. So that can happen. Your measurement result indicates the spin was pointed down. When you decouple it, the spin is pointed up. OK. And it's disturbed. Note that it's disturbed your reference frame when that happens. So your reference frame is not as good as it was. So the question then becomes, how quickly does this reference frame degrade as we repeat this action? We keep adding in more spin half particles in a completely mixed state. We project onto the total J. We trace out the spin again. What are we left with on the J system? Okay. And this is just the general expression for the fidelity here. If you want to imagine not just doing it for J, small J equals a half, you could extend this to any set. So like if it was spin 1, it would be I equals minus 1, 0, 1. And so in the corresponding projectors. In the case that Bartlett looked at, the fidelity turns into this thing, which they found. And n is the number of repetitions. So as the step you're on. So if it's the nth spin, that's the fidelity. Okay, the chance of you getting it right. So they looked at the number of uses of the reference frame before it fell through below a certain threshold, and they found it to go like J squared. So J is the size of your reference frame. It's an index of the size of your reference frame. And this is actually a very interesting scaling. For most related work on reference frames, error was found to go as, say, 1 over the size of the reference frame, or in this case it would be n goes like J. But we have here n goes like J squared. So this was actually a very interesting result. People started wondering about it. Poulon and Yard later put out a paper in which they noticed that if you polarize the spins, right, so they're now not in completely mixed state, but there's some overall polarization to this maybe bath of spins that you're drawing spins from. This actually kind of provides an axis for your problem, right? So what happens is your large spin reference just drifts over and adopts the polarization of the bath. And in that case, the scaling goes as might be expected from other work, like just like J. Okay. Now, what JC noticed and was a cool way of looking at this problem is that fidelity can be expressed as a function of the moments of the angular momentum, the z projection of the angular momentum. Okay, so this is just a standard equation for the expectation value. That's the map that is described by coupling in the little spin, performing the projection, tracing it out. So the map is psi. And so this is the new expectation value after the map is performed. And we can put it right into our expression for fidelity. We're also going to be dealing with higher order moments. So m to the l, and then you stick jz to the l here. Okay. And so fidelities can be functions of higher order moments. In this case, it's just a function of the first order moment. So the nice thing about this is it's very composable now. So we can do one iteration of the map and stick in, well, as soon as we derive some things, stick in what this will be, and then maybe more iterations of the map, and it composes very nicely. So okay. We, in our work, have considered a much more general set of transformations. So they consider a very specific physical problem. We've extended this to all covariant maps, OK? So I'll give you examples of things that fall under this towards the end of the talk. But what we mean is this relation here is obeyed. So if you rotate the state, do the mapping, and then rotate it back, it's the same as if you just did the map. Okay, and when I say rotate, all the rotations are part of SU2, or members of SU2. Okay, in general, you can express all covariant maps on the state rho, which is the reference state, in this form. I know it looks a bit ugly, but if you stare at it for a minute, you'll see that it's not actually. All we're doing is each term is applying another set of J operators and summing over them. Okay, and the sums are independent, right? So it's just applying the same map over and over again as you extend up in the terms. Okay. Now, map of this form is covariant, and all covariant maps can be written this way. And I'm going to provide you a sketch of the proof in a second. But just point out, in case this is looking really alien, you've not seen anything like this in your life, the depolarizing channel on a qubit is an example of this. Okay, so you can see it just takes the first two terms, okay? And the number of terms there are reflects the size of the reference frame, right? So there are two J terms where J is the size of the spin. Okay. So I'm going to sketch the proof. If some of the words here don't make sense, come back to me in two slides. Okay. So we can express this covariance condition in terms of the Liouville representation. So now we have kind of matrices where we previously had operators, and we have a vector where we previously had rho. So we've just vectorized rho, and that's what I've written there for V. So now our condition is that we must have this new map E bar, which is it's the same map in a new representation, but it must commute with R tensor R star. Okay, the commutant can be written as a kind of a sum expansion over the projectors onto the different M spaces. This is the spaces of different kind of angular momentum Z projection. So I didn't say this before. Did everyone know what M is? So it's just the eigenvalue of the projection of the JZ operator. Okay. So it's kind of how much has this been pointed along the Z axis. Okay. So we have projectors over that. And so that's 2j plus 1 independent projectors that make up C. To characterize every possible mapping, we're going to require 2j plus 1 independent operators in our map so that we cover the whole space. Okay. So again, in the Liouville representation, we can write out what E bar actually is now. Actually, this is psi, isn't it? Psi bar? All right, if I say E, I mean psi. Which now just looks like an expansion as a power series, which is nice. Also note that now what we're interested in would be the eigenvalues of this thing, and that the eigenvalues of the nth term of this are just the nth power of the eigenvalues of this thing. So they're all diagonal on the same basis. It's really nice. How are we going to find that? How are we going to find those? What we need to show is that the eigenvalues are not degenerate. So they're all different, so that we have, well, I'll show you, but the full covering of all the roots of the polynomial. So we expand this thing out, which there is no intuition for this. It just works. Expand this thing out. I've just rearranged down here. So this thing equals twice this thing plus this thing plus this thing, and I've just rearranged. But now, notice that this is just a total angular momentum projection measurement. And so is this. So we can write that down here. And this is just the total angular momentum of a joint system, which is composed of two spin J systems. Okay, so we know what the eigenvalues of these things have to be. We also know now that K can range from 0 to 2J, because those are the possible ways you could add two spin J systems together. Those are the possible new total angular momenta you could get. CK are just the appropriate Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. So now what we had, the map is looking like a polynomial over these things. And we can show that all the roots are then unique, because there's 2J plus 1 different values of K. So we have 2J plus 1 different eigenvalues, so we're good. So we have all the freedom we need to talk about all the covariant maps. So that this map covers everything. I'm just putting it up again so you can look at it again. It's very nice. And it describes all covariant maps. Okay, in terms of these nice angular momentum operators. If you're a physicist, you like angular momentum operators. We know what the commutation relations are. Okay, you can come back to me now if you were away for the proof sketch. How do the moments of the JZ operator evolve under such a map? So you're looking at this and you're thinking, I'm lying and I'm cheating, but if you go back and look at this map, it does in fact behave in this way. You can just permute about all of the J operators as appropriate, and we get to this. Repeated use of angular momentum commutation So this identity is found by repeatedly commuting these things past the JIs. And eventually, if you do it, you can make it kind of ugly functions of just JZ. Okay, and the reason I've raised this to the L here is because I'm going to talk about maybe the Lth moment, right? So M to the L. So I might need as high as L. Anyway, I can expand this out, and I just get a function of JZs and no other operators at all. Okay, so now I have the nice thing that I can expand the new trace in terms of the old traces, right? So if I can know the trace before I started, I can know the expectation value of M before I started, I can now work out what the expectation value of M was after I do the map. And the map could be one iteration of coupling in this particle and tracing it out. It could be 100 iterations of that. I'm free to define it as I like. What we have is these summations where so what we can have now is we could have the M to the L moment depending on lower order moments, but not higher order moments. And only if it's an odd order, it can only depend on odd. And if it's even, it can only depend on even order moments. Okay, so we've restricted them with parameters this can possibly vary as. And now we're going to show we can know what the parameters are. Okay, so this is a simple example because the general case is ugly. But suffice it to say, it works. In Bartlett's case, from the map, we could work out what the scaling has to be. So what we do is we do our process I was talking about before, where we just commute this past. We find this is the function. We just plug in to, okay, yeah, so it's the first order, so it only depends it can only depend on the odd orders, and it can only go up to L. So if L equals 1, it only can have one term, which is the one you see here. We can work out what A1 is in terms of the Q0s now, because we know this thing. So we plug these things in. This is just equal to this. If you want to do it n times, you raise it to the nth power, because we can just compose these things, right? So as we repeat the map, we're just going to get more factors of A1 appearing. So, and then that allows us to work out what the what sort of scaling we're going to see on this as we repeat it n times, which is that it goes is the order of n, and it goes over j squared, 1 over j squared, okay? Which is what they found. But the joy of this is we can do this now for any covariant map, okay? Not just the one they looked at. And provided that the Qs do not depend on J, and I have good reason to believe they do not, but JC and I have not discussed this in detail. Provided the Qs do not depend on J, then all covariant maps scale with this 1 over J squared. So this is a feature of covariant maps, not just of the particular physical scenario they're talking about, but it's a feature of covariant maps. You have a... should be, yes. Oh, okay, yeah, so... The reason I don't want them depending on J in my mind is I can find maps. If it would be nice to think of a map as being somewhat independent of, I guess, the size of the system you're doing it on. So, like, I can have a depolarizing channel on a qubit, or I can have one on a Q-trit, or I can, whatever I like, right? Or I get, maybe it's a bad word, but I could on a spin one or a spin, yeah, upwards. If that's to be the case, it'll either break as J goes to a half, or it'll break as J goes to infinity. If we have it depending on J, you'll get behavior you shouldn't see. Oh, I should have mentioned, the Qs should all sum to 1. So there's things cropping up that you wouldn't like to see if you allow them to depend on J in limits. But I know that's hand-wavy, but I swear it's coming to you in the paper. So anyway. In which case, this would be that all these maps have this scaling. And that's actually kind of an interesting thing too, because it means if I have a large spin J and I'm measuring, you know, spin 1, it's the same as if I'm measuring a spin 2 in terms of how, so the factor out the front can change, and it will change, but it still falls off as 1 over J squared, which is kind of interesting. Okay, so the J equals 1 case, this is just examples of things you might do with this otherwise, right? So it's much more general than just what Bartlett and Rudolph and Speckens and Turner were doing. So this is the J equals 1 case. You have a large J spin. You take a small spin, small J equals 1. You couple it in. Now there's 3 states it could be in. It could be plus 1, 0, minus 1 projections along the z-axis. So the fidelity looks like this. We have this dependence on the moments. We can work out how they scale. We can find A1, A2, A0, A2. And we can plot curves of how they fall off. For different J values, the highest curve is J equals 100, the lowest curve is J equals 20, as you might expect. And it's with N, which is repetitions of the map. So you do it over and over again, this is how it falls off. You could also look at this for fidelity against J, the size of the system, with different numbers of repetitions. More repetitions is a worse fidelity. But larger J is a better fidelity. Oh, so my bottom curve should be n equals 100, and my top curve should be n equals 20 here. Sorry. Thank you for saying that. I meant to say it because it's here too. Yeah. Fidelity can't fall below 1/3. Thank you very much, Martin. The reason it cannot is because it's never worse than just guessing. So if I just guess, all right, I flip a 3-sided coin. All right, and I get 0, 1, or minus 1. It can't do me any worse than that. So that is why it falls off to here. In Bartlett's case, it falls off to 1 over 2. Okay, so another case we can do is we can look at the unitary gate case. So let us suppose what we want to use our J reference for now is to serve as an axis for rotation on a qubit. So maybe we just want to use it, well, I guess we have to just use it, say, as say, the z-axis. I mean, we could pick which axis, but it's perfectly symmetric, right? So we have a large J system that's going to find first the z-axis, and we're going to do a rotation about that large spin J, and that's going to be an operation on our qubit, okay? So what we're going to try to do is a z-style operation. But again, just like before, doing this will perturb the reference system, so we can make a map and discuss how it evolves. So you can't perform the one little rotation without having some back action. And XKCD provides a good kind of classical notion of what might be going on. So I have to say, this looks good on paper and seems reasonable, but I've found that there's more romantic ways to spend evenings with people. Just a warning. OK, so now we wish to implement a Z operation using this method. So we're just going to rotate it through pi around the axis defined by the J spin. What we're actually implementing is not a unitary gate Z, but this super operator here, where I'm about to define these things. So the super operator looks like that, and you're saying that's ugly, ugly, ugly. It kind of is. This is your reference system, which is initially in the state JM. This is the qubit state, which you're trying to work. Oh, I've written this in a bad way. You're going to have to forgive me. This is the qubit state, but this is the reference state after. So I'm sorry. All right, my bad. I've used rho to mean two different things there. Bear with me. This is what we're doing is we're integrating over all the possible different directions we could find the big J spin to be pointing in, and then we're rotating to match our notion of Z, the Z gate. Okay, so we're just rotating Z so it matches what our J, big J spin is. Is that all I have on there? I guess it is. So then we find we put this into an expression for gate fidelity, where these are just the Krauss operators that I had up here. And the Krauss operators are just kind of half of this thing. I can write it up if you care, but no one does, do they? Okay. So this is the fidelity. You have to trust me a lot in this talk, I guess. D is the dimension of the system, which in this case, yeah, is, I guess, goes like J. So the fidelity for this map looks like this, where you'll notice an interesting kind of feature. It now depends on the second moment and just the second moment and not the first moment. So even for qubits, there's maps we can get where it goes as not just the first moment, but the second moment. So there's actually a lot of kind of interesting behavior you can come across that's all still defined by covariant maps. But there we go. So to summarize, the reference frames that have size that's comparable to your quantum system. So if J is not close to infinity, you really should be treating these things quantum mechanically and looking at the back action. Because if you keep using them, eventually your notions of axes will become bad. They will become unhelpful. And that leads to decoherence effects. What we have is a generic way of expressing any covariant map in terms of angular momentum operators. That might actually be the single most interesting thing that's come out of this, maybe. It might be useful for modeling noise, I should imagine. Using this form of covariant map, we can come up with a characterization for future dynamics of a reference frame under a whole host of different operations, say, different physical processes. And we have this for any covariant map. So future work, it might be nice to look for useful forms that work for other classes of maps, so not covariant maps, but other classes that come up in physical processes. It might be nice if we could also write those in terms of J's. If we can't, what can we write them in terms of? It also would be interesting to look at the case where a record is kept of measurement results. So there are some cases in which I could say, I know my reference frame got this one right, and if I do, can I hang on to that information? So it can't perfectly fix everything, because the fidelity wasn't one even the first time you use a map, but it could get you something, perhaps, if you kept a measurement record. Those are my references. If you really want to know about reference frames generally, this bottom one is great. This is the one I've been talking about repeatedly. And all the quant pH numbers, all these papers are accepted in very nice journals. It's just that I find this easier. So that's it.
Cut it wherever you want, and you can get rid of it.
Sure. Oh, this is a good point. Yeah. Yeah. It's just like choosing. I think you're right, actually.
No, good.
Yeah, I do know what you mean. What you're saying is just that it's kind of, if J is actually acting kind of like a constant R thing anyway, it's kind of pointless to then. Yeah, I think this is what I was kind of trying to think, but you've put it better than I have, so. Oh, wow. Did I put everyone to sleep? I'm sorry about that.